Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Oh, Miles here.
Your Owlpost for the week is delivered for the first time in the new year. Of course, in the future, this won't really matter, but welcome back, everybody. We're excited to be here. I am just one of the hosts, Matthew Rushing, and with me, as she is always, from the future of 2020, Drea Kaufman.
Hello.
Hello.
Although I think it still matters to people, even if they're listening to it in syndicate.
That's true.
I like to think we matter.
Yeah. It's fun. I mean, yeah, we're in the future now. We are in the 20s of 2020. So, like, I don't know. I still don't have, you know, flying cars or anything. So that's a little disappointing.
Yeah. The movies definitely lied to us in the 80s.
They sure did. Dang you.
But that's okay.
Anyway, but.
We still have magic to go back.
That's true.
To,
so. We still have Harry
I'm
Potter,
good with that.
So thank God for that. And we're on chapter 13 here of The Half-Blood Prince, The Secret Riddle. And before we get there, you can find us wherever you get your podcasts. Make sure you're subscribed so you get the podcast as soon as it drops. You can also give us a star rating review over there on Apple Podcasts, still where most people get their podcasts is through Apple devices and through the, you know, it's not iTunes anymore. It's Apple Podcasts now, even in on your desktop or your laptop or your phone or iPad or wherever it is. Just make sure you're subscribed. You can find us over on Twitter at Join Nerd Party. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/thenerdparty. You can find us online at thenerdparty.com, which is also a great place where you can catch up with Drea and I by sending us an email over on the contact section. If you choose Owlpost, Drea and I get that email, and then we can talk to you that way. So much obviously happened. We got through a new year, Drea, and a lot has been happening for Harry because he's waiting for his evening to meet with Dumbledore for their next lesson. And I thought that it was very interesting that quite immediately, you know, with his meeting with Dumbledore, that we find out how Katie is doing, which she's doing well, but it seems like this is going to take a while for her to be back at school.
Yeah, we kind of find out that this curse is probably much worse than they had originally suspected, and by them I mean the kids or the teens or the trio or whatever, the students. There we go, that's what I'm looking for, the students. Still getting in the hang of it, y'all, just bear with me here. So yeah, it's a lot worse than they had originally expected, and it comes to find out she basically touched this necklace through the tiniest hole in her glove. And it has knocked her on her tuchus. And they basically said that if she straight on touched it with bare skin, like her whole hand, or if she put it on, she would likely have died instantly.
Yeah, it's bad. And it was so bad, in fact, that...
It's real bad.
it's real bad, folks.
Real bad.
Dumbledore explains that Snape, it's lucky that he was there, and Harry's like, what the heck? Well, why not Madame Pomfrey? Who cares about Snape? And we realize, we have Dumbledore explain to us that, you know, Snape has a lot more experience with the dark arts, and because he was there, he was able to really help make sure that she's going to be okay. And we get that she's been sent to St. Mungo's, and they've been sending Dumbledore hourly reports. Man, that's a hard word to say sometimes. Katie will make a full recovery, but it is definitely going to take more time than we're used to with these students recovering from these, you know, magical ailments that they get. And so it really does go to show just how bad this could have been for anybody who had touched this necklace. And so when we think about who it might be have meant for, this necklace was no joke.
It's interesting too, because this whole time we're kind of having this conversation, because in here we also have Harry sort of seeing if Dumbledore knows his, you know, suspicions and his concerns about Malfoy. But we end up with Phineas Black, I guess, on the wall, who keeps getting really uppity with the way that Harry is conversing with Dumbledore. So much so that when Harry asks Dumbledore if, you know, he knows about Madungus selling all of the black stuff, that, you know, the portrait storms off out of this portrait and into another one. But it's just another like little touch she gives to keep something that's so grounded in reality, like an even greater magical touch, right? There's a talking portrait of a former headmaster conversing with them as well. So it was just really, it's just a little thing. And, you know, just, I think Harry feels a little vindicated when the portrait gets upset that Sirius's stuff is being sold, or the Black family heirlooms are being sold off as well. And, you know, Dumbledore does a good job of sort of like tampering some of Harry's angst in this first chapter. It's kind of like a quick catch up before we actually go into the lesson. But Dumbledore is still very controlling of the narrative and what's being discussed and being shared, which is, you know, pretty standard for Dumbledore and their conversations. And at some point, Harry asks him a question about something, and he goes, "Well, you'll find out soon enough." And it surprises him, and he's like, "What do you mean? Like, I will? Okay." It's just such an interesting little, like, introduction to their lesson that the majority of the chapter is about.
Yeah, it is really interesting because he asked, you know, Dumbledore where he's been on his journeys recently, you know, and it is, I mean, we're not used to Dumbledore saying, "Oh yeah, I'll probably end up having to tell you about that." And Harry's like, "What? Really? Like, you're not just going to brush me off?" So I think what it really does is it is helping set a real difference between the relationship and where Harry and Dumbledore are now, and that this is like Dumbledore is going to be dispensing all of this information to which Harry wants to know the answer. And yet at the same time, there is a logical reason for the things that that Dumbledore is sharing and the times in which he will share it, because as we, you know, to break the chapter here for a moment, that we're going to see at the end, we get the reference to the ring, and we still haven't heard the story about what happened with Dumbledore's hand that had that ring on it. So that's still something where we're going to get that story, but we haven't gotten it yet. And so I think that's really interesting to see. It's kind of a parental thing, right, too. Like, Harry, with Dumbledore here, it almost does feel like a parent. Like, there's a reason that I'm telling you certain things now, but not telling you everything now, because you won't understand it until we get there, right? But you got to trust me. And I think that's really interesting, because this is, I think, a place where Harry and Dumbledore are trying to build even more trust. And it's a little bit difficult that, you know, for Harry, he's not getting the answer he kind of wants about the whole Malfoy situation. But luckily, he's able to let that go so they can go on the journey. So
I can see where you're going with that and the parental approach to this communication style. I didn't so much take it as a parental approach, because at the end of the last book, Dumbledore essentially gave Harry no reason to trust him. We had seen trust shattered. Harry lost his cool, right? Went a little all over the room and destroyed the room. Like, there's still a rebuilding of the trust going on. And I always saw this portion of their relationship as like Dumbledore wants to try something different with Harry, right? He's tried a couple different things with him so far. And I feel like this one, and I feel like some of the tertiary outerlying elements here are trying to show you that the relationship that Dumbledore and Harry have is different than a headmaster and a student, mm-hmm. right? That's part of their relationship. But the fact that the portrait keeps saying that he'd never have let a student speak to him the way that Harry was speaking with Dumbledore, like, yes, that's partially, that's going to be just a difference in headmaster preferences and things. And I feel, you know, Dumbledore is going to have a very different approach than the headmaster in the portrait. But there's a few other things that happen. We see Dumbledore interacting with another student. We see some of these things, and it just shows you how different Harry's relationship is with Dumbledore. And I think that this whole thing is Dumbledore's attempt to maintain control of this master plan he has, because he's a control freak. That's what he is. That's how he does. I'm not going to judge it. I have my moments. But I think he's got this master plan constructed, and he's trying to sort of puppet master everything, but he's trying to give a little bit more and be a little bit more flexible for any of us who are type A's and have been told we have to be a little less type A in certain circumstances. I feel like he's really trying in this relationship, but there's just some things, and maybe that's where your parental piece comes in, right? There's just some pieces that he worries what's going to happen if he shares that, right? Is it going to take Harry's attention somewhere else? Is he going to have an emotional reaction? We don't know, because we haven't seen it play out. But there's just, I think that this whole chapter between what we actually learn in the pensive memory and just the interaction is meant to just show you a new relationship and a different relationship that is special between Dumbledore and Harry. Especially because, as we come to learn, the pensive memory we're going into is actually Dumbledore's. So not only is he going back to his own memory, he's inviting someone else in, which has to be the weirdest thing ever to know you're inviting someone in to see the world from your perspective. It's scary. So I just think it's such a, it's a good step. We're going to keep getting these and going. But the introduction is builds on that last one, where the last lesson there was this awkward, like, so how are your classes going? Any cute girls this semester, Harry? Right? Like, there's this like sort of back and forth. And I think this is just the evolution of that back and forth, combined with, you know, Dumbledore playing puppet master a little bit.
Yeah. And it's really interesting because we start with visiting some memories. But before we do that, Harry and Dumbledore have a little bit of a conversation where Dumbledore kind of sets up what we're going to see first, and that he is piecing together, Dumbledore is, you know, what's going on with Voldemort's mother and where she is and why she's there, and the fact that she has landed in London, where she is destitute and desperate for any type of funds, and she ends up selling the necklace, the Slytherin necklace. And she not only ends up selling it, but she sells it to somebody that we are very familiar with, who actually started the store. He is a Burke. And so I think that's fascinating that not only does he sell it to her, but he basically swindles her out of what it's really worth, giving her 10 galleons, knowing that this is probably worth a small fortune, and is very happy with himself for having done so. We find out, too, that, you know, she gives birth to Tom and dies almost immediately afterwards. It was really interesting, too, because before we get to the main memory, they have this moment where Harry asks a question about, like, couldn't she even just stay alive for her son? And Dumbledore says to him, not feeling sorry for Voldemort, are you? And there is this moment of, like, humanity that is going to be hugely important for the very end of the series. It really is, like, it's a very tiny moment here, but it's this moment that is going to continue to have repercussions till the very end when we come to the end of the final showdown between, I don't think I'm spoiling anything, that there's going to be a final showdown between Harry and Voldemort at the end of the series. And this is going to be, this is going to play into that moment. And I just think it's brilliant because as Dumbledore explains, you know, of, you know, not trying to judge her too harshly and knowing just how badly she's been treated. And he even alludes to the fact that he thinks that possibly the fact that she hasn't used magic at all, that she may have actually been sapped of her powers. And because of not only the way she's been treated, but the despair that she is in. And Dumbledore says that that can actually happen. So that, like, she's basically lost her magic, possibly. So it's a little speculation, but it's just fascinating when we see just how badly this woman has been treated and what it's done to her.
Just so, even thinking about the comparison they draw, like, so very briefly between Harry's mom and Voldemort's mom, right? And you know, he was like, well, it's like my mom didn't have a choice, right? Like, she didn't have a choice to die. She was killed. And Dumbledore kind of slyly slips in there like, no, she had a choice, like, what to do with it, right? Like, thinking about what would she do with her death? How would she take it? Because she did have a choice. She could have run. She could have hidden. She could have left Harry there, right? She had choices. It just, it really speaks to compounding on this idea that being a parent is one of the, like, you have to be selfless, right? Like, you have to, like, your kids become the, it's just this different, it's different. I don't even know how to describe it. It's different, right? And Harry's mom did the most selfless thing she could do in protecting her child. And if you think about Voldemort's mom or Tom Riddle's mom in a similar sense, like, she could not protect him. She could not care for him. She knew she would not be able to give him the love and attention and upbringing that he needed. And she had given up on life. And for her, the selfless thing to do was to not put him through that, right? She thought she was doing the right thing by her kid by letting herself die. I mean, that's part of that whole depression and suicide thing, right? You think that no longer being here is the best thing for the people in your life. So it's so interesting because it has this element of choice and also this element of not having a choice all at the same time. But it's a really sad, very dark thing to kind of think about, like her leaving her child. So it's just so interesting. And it does. It really humanizes Tom Riddle a little bit, right? Especially because this whole time we're talking about him as Tom Riddle until the very end. Mm-hmm. There's this very distinct transition between calling him Tom and calling him Lord Voldemort. And Dumbledore even points this out and explains this thought process of which name kind of means what at the end of this section. And so it's just so, so interesting. It's this chapter is very subtle. It's not very long. There's not even that much in it. It's just packed with a lot of subtleties that play into other things. And then we actually get to the memory after we kind of go through the parents. And I mentioned earlier that it's Dumbledore's memory. And we find ourselves at the orphanage.
Yeah, this is really fascinating. And I love this part because Dumbledore is subtly using some magic to get the answers that he wants from this Mrs. Cole. And, you know, they sit down and they're having this conversation. I love that. Dumbledore makes appear some gin that apparently she's a big fan of so that she will begin to talk more. And she begins to kind of spill out all of these things about this young child named Tom and how, of course, his mother had died right away after he had been born. And he's always been different, that he never really cried as a child and that he is kind of odd. That he doesn't really have a lot of friends and that weird things happen like dead bunnies in the attic and kids coming back from a thing at the beach, a trip at the beach.
Field trip.
Yeah, yeah. That are not quite right when they come back. And so
I do find it really funny, though, that in this whole thing, you know, he gives her the gin and he's kind of like not really interrogating her, but, you know, questioning her. And she's like, are you sure there's no way you're going to change your mind and not take him? And he goes, no, no, no. And then he goes, oh, yeah, by the way, he is going to come back during the summer. Like, he'll still be here during the summer. So, and then you almost see her face like, crap.
Yeah.
Like, you can just, she tells him all these horrible things and she's like, crap, he's not gone. He's just mostly gone. I thought that was probably my favorite part of the little interrogation with the house mistress, I guess. I don't know what else you'd call her, but yeah, I thought that was pretty funny.
Well, and what I what's really interesting is by the time we get to actually meet Tom, this is the part where I would say that the movie does a good job of playing this section out of just when we meet Tom. They don't actually do the part where, you know, we have the other memory and
the head,
yeah, all that stuff, which is actually really important to set the context of meeting this character. But we can see here through this meeting with Tom, Dumbledore's first meeting with him, that, you know, he is somebody who has been learning that he can use his power to get what he wants from people, and that he's using his power in a way that treats others cruelly. And so I think
the movie doesn't even do this section justice. Like, the movie's pretty creepy, mm-hmm. I guess. It's pretty eerie, but I think that the book here makes it even more sort of cold and manipulative. Like, you do get that sense of, like, that at the end, you know, Dumbledore even says, like, he consciously knew what he was doing and was trying to do those things. And that, I think, that whole part doesn't come through in the movie as much as it does in the book, is that, like, conscious effort to do those things, I feel like, is so much creepier and more sinister in the book than it is in the movie. But that's just,
yeah, no, I mean, I would agree with that. I mean, I think you're absolutely right. I think the movie does a good job of giving us a creepy Tom Riddle, but the nuance, yes, that we get here is definitely not the same. And
it's because the movie was just shorter, yeah, right?
Absolutely.
They only exchange a few sentences, and you get almost like a quick flashback in the movie, and this one's mm-hmm. definitely like a full memory we're experiencing. So I definitely, I agree. I think the actor did a great job, and the way that played out was probably exactly what they wanted, but I think that you get way more context here.
Right.
I mean, you always do in a book than you do in a movie, but I don't know why I'm even speculating, but
no, I think
I'm a little more afraid of the book Lord Voldemort than I am the movie.
Oh,
so
yes, I mean, and I think one of the things that we get here too is we automatically get the understanding that Voldemort, as Tom, already does not like authority. When he's said that, you know, you will address me as professor or sir, you know, he doesn't really like this idea, but he does like the idea of being able to learn to hone magic. And the fact that, you know, Dumbledore makes him return the things that he's stolen. And so I love the end where Harry and Dumbledore are having this conversation about the things that we really learn here. And not only that, I mean, he gets meat to steaks. So I think is fascinating that Dumbledore says, it wasn't his ability to speak to snakes that scared me the most, really, or intrigued me the most about him, but it was his contempt for people and his utter lack of feeling towards anyone, like, that really intrigued Dumbledore in the sense that, like, he was going to be keeping a close eye on this kid. And the fact that we've seen this, like you were saying earlier, like, we've seen this play out. People may say that they're friends of Voldemort, but Voldemort doesn't really have any friends, and that he hates being considered quote unquote normal. He likes to be known as being special.
Right. And that's why he hated his name Tom, and why he shed that, because he needed to be titled versus named. There were so many things. We got such an interesting and accurate profile of Voldemort here in this discussion, right? Like, he mentions he likes to collect trinkets, mm-hmm. and that the things he had stolen from the kids weren't kept because he wanted, you know, he wanted a yo-yo. No, he wanted the trophy for whatever he did, and the yo-yo happened to be the trophy. that's something that is totally lost on the movies and is so important as we move on with the rest of these books. That little note. And it's so important that, you know, we even kind of circle back to it literally as Harry leaves the office. we call back to it when he mentions the ring isn't there and he expected to see the mouth organ, which I'm guessing is a harmonica.
Yes.
Something like that. Yeah. The grossest name for a harmonica ever, by the way. I'm so sorry for those who may have offended, but that's disgusting. You learned so much about him, and it even says things like, you know, he didn't want an escort to Diagon Alley. And I love Harry thinking what's going to happen and then it not happening. Harry's like, oh, there's no way he's going to let him go by himself. Oh, he did. Okay. There's no way he's going to let that happen. Oh, nope. Totally did. Okay. It's hard to tell if it's lessons learned in terms, and I think that feeds back into my earlier point, like Dumbledore would not let those things happen to Harry because Harry is special to him, not because that's the headmaster's job. And I think part of this is Harry needing to realize that some of the things he's experiencing aren't normal. They're not the norm. They're not what everyone gets and everyone experiences, and that his relationships with these people are unique and special, and be it because he's the savior or the chosen one or whatever you want to call him, or because he's just, I mean, people don't want to be around Voldemort. He makes that very clear. He doesn't want friends. He doesn't value them, and he's not going to take the time to make them. So it's just, we get such that you just learn how opposite Lord Voldemort is from Harry, even with similar upbringings, similar things that could have led them to be the same. They're very, very different.
Yeah, it was fascinating to me to see, you know, obviously the fact that Harry thinks he knows what Dumbledore is going to do with Tom, and that's not what Dumbledore does. And I didn't just take it as that Harry is special to Dumbledore, which he is. But I also felt like this is one of those places where we've seen that Dumbledore is younger at this point, and he doesn't do things the same way he would do them now. And like, there's a progression of that character. Like, we get a picture that Dumbledore, I mean, if Harry had asked him, I think he would have said he would have done things differently, you know, because obviously he says, I didn't know that I just met the most famous dark wizard of our time and what he would become. But I was going to keep an eye on him. And I think, obviously, if he could go back, he would have kept a much better eye on this, you know, this kid.
I also think that to that point, that goes back to the like profile of Voldemort. Like, he's got this sense like there's those people you just don't want to be around them. You know, he's uncomfortable. He's creeped out. There's this personal want to not be around this kid anymore than he has to. So he does his obligation and he offers. But when he's declined, he is like, "Woo! I don't have to do that. I don't have to go." Right. It doesn't really come through as like a celebration, but there's got to be an element of that as well, because it's very clear that this kid creeps out even Dumbledore. Right.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
He doesn't want to be around him. So he's not going to if he doesn't have to, which again goes back to him being younger, right? As an older wizard or if knowing more or wiser, he probably would have been, I don't really want to do this, but I'm going to insist anyway. So I totally agree. I think there's so many pieces to that whole part. But I do love that. Yeah. Harry thinks Dumbledore is going to do one thing and he doesn't. And I think that teaches Harry a lot about Dumbledore and his journey too.
Yeah, and like you were mentioning earlier, and I think this is the thing that's really fascinating about this chapter, is there's so much nuance and there's so many little things that we learn here. It doesn't seem like we learn a lot or that this is like the most pivotal chapter, but all of these things really are truly going to play into the end of the series. Like, where we learned things here that mean so much by the time we get to the end, and so each one of these times we're having one of these lessons with Dumbledore, we really are learning something. And as we've talked about Harry Potter kind of being the series itself being like a puzzle, she's putting in a lot of pieces here. I think that you don't realize how important they're going to be later to the picture, you know, but they truly are going to make this picture a lot clearer. And so it's really exciting the fact that we're already at this point in this book.
Building on all of that, this is also one of those moments where we learn and are reminded of Dumbledore's humanity and how he's not infallible, right? Which we kind of get this idea that he's this great, powerful wizard and doesn't make mistakes, and that whole controlling element, right? There's some of this to that too. And I think we'll come to learn more and more about Dumbledore and why being around someone like Tom Riddle makes him really uncomfortable as we go through the rest of the series. So I think that this is such an important chapter that doesn't really seem like an important chapter when you start it. When I started reading it, I was like, oh, I remember this chapter. Doo-doo-doo. And then I was like, oh, okay. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yep. All right. So.
Yeah, it's going to be fun to be able to get through this book this year. And honestly, I'm kind of in the edge of my seat. I can't wait for where we're going. You know, this is such a pivotal part of the series, obviously. And so we're excited to be back and be with Owlpost for the rest of the year. And if you would like to catch up with us and talk to maybe Drea, maybe they want to talk to you about some things, where can they find you online?
Sure, you can find me on Twitter at PCFChick. Or on Instagram at Drea Kaufman, and it's COFFMAN.
And you could find me on Twitter, Instagram, Letterboxd, Vero under the name MattRushing02. I'm here on the network doing aggressive negotiations with John Mills as we talk about Star Wars every week. Obviously, so much Star Wars stuff coming out these days. So lots for us to talk about. Hope you'll catch up with us there. You can also find me on the Trek FM network. I do two shows. There's one called The Orb with Chris Jones, where we talk about Star Trek Deep Space Nine. You can also find me doing the General Geek Show, doing all of the fandoms we love, not just one. So that's a lot of fun to that's a blast, so I hope you'll check that out. And then last but not least, I do a show called Cinema Stories with my good friend Courtney, and that is where we talk about films but through the lens of faith. Thank you so much for checking your Owlpost.
Mischief managed.
Join the revolution. Join the Nerd Party.